From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. Listeners just like you. And we are so thankful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, December 6th is the Christian Day of St. Nicholas. Monday marks the Buddhist observance of Rahatsu Bodhi Day, as well as the Catholic feast of the Immaculate Conception. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
At a time when faiths are seen wrongly as a cause of conflict, it is a sign of real hope that today global faith leaders have together committed themselves publicly to the battle to end modern slavery.
Pope Francis continues to make news with his level of interreligious engagement, whether that be his meeting with the head of the Christian Orthodox Church in Istanbul or the call for an end to human trafficking worldwide that the Pope signed along with a diverse and influential group of faith leaders. On this week's show, I'll talk with Josephine McKenna, a veteran journalist who covers the Vatican beat for Religion News Service.
And they said, we have just included water and sanitation in the Millennium Development Goals. Then we got a call from the White House. They said, get up here and let's talk about what does the U.S. do in order to create the commitment that we have made to water.
Well, it's true that there are no current Ebola patients in the U.S. The situation remains dire in several West African nations. Among the key concerns is something we take for granted in the global north, basic sanitation. As the Water for the World Act faces a congressional vote, I'll talk about Malcolm Morris of Living Water International and the Millennium Water Alliance. But first,
How long do you think this Ferguson story is going to roll?
I think it's already dwindling.
Well, this is probably the first of many protests.
Protests are calling for an end to racial profiling and the excessive use of force by police, especially against the nation's black population.
It has been disheartening to watch a painful racial rift become more and more glaring in this country. On this show, we will continue to address the broad challenges to justice and equality that have been revealed by recent events. But amidst all the turmoil and breaking news headlines, we also absolutely must take the time to look at what works in resolving inequities and seemingly insurmountable conflicts. That's why this week, even as protests continue in many cities across the nation, I'm very pleased to bring to you a conversation with the Reverend William Barber II, founder of the Moral Monday Movement and head of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP. And he's out with a new book that's both a telling of recent history and a compelling call to action. The title is Forward Together, A Moral Message for the Nation. And I'm very pleased that the publication of this book brings Reverend Barber back to State of Belief Radio. Reverend Barber, welcome back.
Thank you so much, my friend. It's glad to be with you on today.
This is an exciting book. Would you talk about the genesis of the idea of expressing your message in this form?
Well, you know, oftentimes in the middle of movements, we don't document what's going on. And the Forward Together Moral Movement, one component of it is the Moral Monday Movement, connects people of all different races, creeds, colors, sexualities, and faiths together in a way that is quite unique, particularly in the South. We've seen, you know, upwards of 100,000 people join in our mass moral march on Raleigh. It is a direct challenge to the immoral activity, we believe, of extremism that's trying to roll back voting rights, attack the poor, attack the sick, attack health care, you know, attack the immigrant community, labor rights community, and the LGBT community. And it gives us a framing that's not limited to liberal versus conservative, Republican versus Democrat, but says there are some things that are constitutionally consistent morally defensible and economically sane, which means there are also some things that are constitutionally inconsistent, morally indefensible, yeah. and economically insane. And so folks said, right, talk about this past year. It may help other people, especially since we started seeing a Moral Monday movement break out across the nation and other places. So with my editor, Barbara Zelter, we sat down and basically took you through Moral Monday, what mm-hmm. happened on some key days, and then the actual prophetic speech or sermon, if you would, that went mm-hmm. along with that, because we believe language is the fundamental beginning of a moral movement. Mm-hmm. You have to get the language right in order to get the actions right. And then we connect you back to some things that even predated last year. And then in the back, we kind of lay out the 12-step methodology. And part of the proceeds will actually go to continuing the movement.
Good. How has the experience of leading the Moral Monday movement informed and maybe even changed your understanding of the hunger that people have for moral leadership?
Well, the hard spade work, you know, the stuff that you don't see on the stage, going to communities. As for instance, when I went to Mitchell County after 13 weeks of civil disobedience in the Capitol, and we took Moral Monday on the road, and we were headed to Asheville, but I got a call to go to Mitchell County, which is 99% white, 89% Republican. And at first I said, why are they inviting me there? Surely it's just to criticize. But we decided to go, and when we got there, we found people who were Republicans, but they were Teddy Roosevelt, Lincoln, Eisenhower Republicans, who were very distraught with Tea Party extremism and understood that when people do things like cut Medicaid and cut unemployment and raise taxes on the working poor and roll back voting rights, it hurts all of us, and that those things are deeply immoral. And we're now organizing there. So I've seen firsthand that by changing the language from mere Republican to Democrat and liberal versus, you can actually build bridges with the language. You know, the Bible says the power of life and death is in the tongue. Mm-hmm. And Brueggemann says it's the poetry of the poets that actually connects us, because they're able to talk what he calls dualistically, mm-hmm. both about grief and about hope. I believe we're in a moral crisis, my friend. I really do. Not just a political crisis, even though I believe politics are deeply moral, budgets are deeply moral. But whenever you can have politicians that will run on a campaign and in essence say, elect me and I'll cut your public education, hurt your teachers, stop your voting rights, undermine your health care, undermine your labor rights, undermine fundamental equal protection under the law, undermine your living wages and opportunity for minimum wage, then they get votes. In many cases, win. And you see people crying about that and hurting. We are in a moral crisis that needs us to do what Isaiah said, yeah. to rise up and cry loud and spare not. And we found, what I found, is it brings people together in ways I could have never met. I would have never imagined, finally, that 1,006 people, I mean, we've been organizing with this Forward Together movement for 7 years, but 1,006 people committed to civil disobedience under this moral banner, more than any time in the history of the South. 65% of them were white, 11 to 13% were Republicans and independents. And we've been at this now over 152 weeks, and it's still growing and still moving.
You know, Reverend Barber, you are so very good at capturing individual stories and sharing them in an inspiring way. Can you offer an anecdote or two from Moral Mondays that would help listeners understand the power of this movement?
Several. The first day that we went into the legislature for the civil disobedience piece, April 29th, in the middle of Pentecost, because on Monday, Thursday of last year, our legislature decided to begin the crucifixion of voting rights, and people said, we've got to do something. Every crucifixion needs a witness. So we had seven ministers to go in of Jewish, Christian, Muslim. We had 10 people to go in, but one of them was a lady by the name of Marty who suffers from cerebral palsy. And I said to her, you know, you don't have to go in. They will probably arrest us. She says, no, I have to go in because I'm thinking about how immoral it is for me to have health insurance and all of the people, 500,000 that this governor and legislature are denying Medicaid expansion simply because they do not like the president. And we knew that when those 25 officers came out and arrested us for praying, singing, and talking loud, i.e. preaching, We knew when they went to Marty and rolled her out in her wheelchair and she held her fist high that something different was happening here.
Yeah.
and sitting in jail all night with her, and she simply says, all I want to do is get out, go back organizing, and if I've got to come again and stay because what's happening is wrong.
Oh,
or when we've had Republican and Democratic teachers stand on the stage together and say, right, we're putting down party. It's immoral to cut public education and hurt children and hurt teachers. Or when we've had Republican and Democrat union workers who lost their unemployment, and I watched an African-American who was a Democrat one day embrace a brother who's Republican who said, you know, I voted for this crowd, but now because of their actions, the only thing I'm sure of is that I'm going to die and I don't know how to pay my mortgage because they have actually cut my unemployment. Hmm. Or finally, when we go up in the mountains, you know, I told you about Mitchell County and we met with them that night, but then the next day in Asheville, 10,000 people showed up. And this past election up in the mountains, Mountain Moral Monday, was the only movement in the country that was successful at rallying people to vote in such a way that incumbent Tea Party extremists were removed from office.
Yeah.
One lady came up to me and said, thanks for 13 weeks of penitence. She was a white lady. She said, I was taught to dislike you, hate you, but this has been like church for me at the General Assembly. It has caused me to remove away from a lot of the things I was taught. I've had atheists say, look, I thought I was an atheist till I went to Moral Monday. I never even heard about, you know, the scriptures and the gospel and this way where we're talking about justice and justice being at the forefront. Thank you for at least broadening my experience.
You have inspired so many people. I've got to ask you, who or what inspires you?
Well, my father, first and foremost, and I would say that only in the course he's second to the scriptures and God. But my father's taught me what it meant to be a Christian and that to be a Christian, a person of faith, and to not care about justice is a terrible oxymoron. And I thank him for that. I love him for that. Every time I'm on stage, I think about him every time I'm preaching, even though he died in 1988, just as I was leaving seminary. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm certainly inspired by the great leadership of black and white fusionist clergy members in 1868 in North Carolina, like Reverend J.W. Hood and Samuel Ashley, who helped rewrite North Carolina's Constitution and built a fusion movement of black and whites in the 1800s. And I say, if they could do it then, and they could transform the South then, surely we can do it now.
Yeah.
I'm inspired by Walter Rauschenbusch and Washington Gladden and the movement of the social gospel movement. I think we need to pick that up more and more today,
absolutely,
particularly in the times in which we live, and understand how it impacted somebody like Teddy Roosevelt, who ended up in 1912 basically saying there are five moral focuses of government ought to be minimum wages and taking on big business and public education and protecting the environment and health care for all. This was, you know, in the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century. What if politicians could be re-challenged with a moral argument today? And then certainly the civil rights movement from Emmett Till's mother, who chose to make America look at racism by not closing the casket, to Rosa Parks, who sat down 4 months after Emmett Till's death.
Yes.
And certainly, you know, Dr. King, my father, so many others who stood up to America and said, listen, you know, we're coming not as politicians, but as modern day prophets who are saying to America, you can be better. And we're going to hold you accountable to what you said on paper. And in essence, if you're going to put your hand on the Bible and swear to uphold its Constitution, we're going to make sure that your budgets, your policies, your laws are measured by both of them.
The Reverend William Barber II is the founder of the Moral Monday movement. He's the president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP. He's pastor of the Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina. Reverend Barber's new book is titled Forward Together, A Moral Message for the Nation. Reverend Barber, it is always inspiring to talk with you, and I can't thank you enough for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. And listen, I want you to join us February 14th. We're going to come back to Raleigh with a mass moral march saying that love and justice can't be voted out, can't be talked away, and can't be repealed. And love for you to come down, your audience to come down. They can go to our website, NAACPNC, and check out the Save the Date that's already there. And thank you so much for your prayers and for allowing me to be on this platform.
Even as Pope Francis has focused his efforts toward issues of justice and human dignity since assuming leadership of the Roman Catholic Church, engaging pressing secular issues in the language of morality and faith. He also regularly has engaged leaders of other faith traditions in pursuit of these goals. How different is that from other recent popes, and how significant is it for those of us who long for inspiring leadership in interreligious terms? I'm joined by Josephine McKenna, a veteran journalist who covers all things Vatican for Religion News Service. She's speaking to us from Rome. Jo, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, I'm great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Pope Francis traveled to Turkey for the Thanksgiving weekend. What was the announced purpose of this trip?
Well, the Pope was invited by the Ecumenical Patriarch, the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church, and also, of course, by the Turkish government. So there was almost a dual purpose to this trip. He also wanted to legitimize Christianity in that region, which, as we know, is really under siege with the violence that's being perpetrated by ISIS. So he wanted to send a very strong message to legitimize Christianity, to reach out to what he perceives perhaps to be a good Muslim country, a legitimate Muslim country, but also to support the Eastern Orthodox faith and also to support Christians who are really at times threatened themselves in a country like Turkey, which is 99% Muslim.
Mm-hmm. I noticed, in fact, in a quote that I read in the secular press that came from just a citizen on the streets in Turkey. What makes the Pope think we're interested in what he thinks about things from his point of view? How did he deal with that kind of questioning or even cynicism?
Well, that's a very important kind of comment, I think, the one that you've mentioned, because unlike his other international visits where he's been mobbed by thousands of Catholics and Christians, in this case, there were very few people on the street, and the country is around 77 million people in Turkey, and only around 120,000 Christians. Now, that's minuscule. And in some cases, the Catholic Church has been concerned about threats against Christians in Turkey itself. And in fact, in the last decade, a Catholic priest and a Catholic bishop were murdered in separate incidents in Turkey. And the Eastern Orthodox faith has also been concerned about increasing threats on some of their members. So it's interesting to see that there was that kind of internal reaction. And you have to ask yourself, who was he really speaking to by undertaking this visit? It obviously wasn't to communicate with Christians on the ground. It was to use this as a platform on a bigger level, on an international level, to communicate certain things that were important to him.
You know, I remember everyone in the news media were amazed that the Roman Catholic Pope and the Eastern Orthodox Patriarch would even get together. And then on this visit, the Roman Catholic Pope submitted to a blessing from Eastern Orthodox Patriarch Bartholomew. Joe, what was the significance of that?
Well, I think that was really an amazing image, an enduring image from this visit, like the one we saw earlier this year on the Pope's visit to the Middle East when he stopped at the wall on the West Bank for a moment of silence. That went around the world. And again, this one did too. And what does it say? It says he has forged a remarkable friendship, a remarkable working relationship with the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, who heads the Eastern Orthodox Church. And this is also putting these two churches back on the road to unification. For most of us in the modern world, we forget that the Eastern Orthodox Church was once part of the Catholic Church and they split nearly 1,000 years ago. So there's potential to get these two back together. for now, I think we're seeing a very powerful personal relationship. When they see each other, they communicate in Italian, incidentally, so they can communicate very freely. And it's about building bridges. And I think ever since day one, Pope Francis has been very strong on that. And he's not only doing it with Bartholomew, he's obviously reaching out to other faiths as well.
Mm-hmm. You write that the Pope said resolving the schism will never happen if left in the hands of theologians.
I wouldn't take that as a criticism from the Pope, but he did make the point on the return trip back to Rome that this is an issue that the issue of reunification has been on the table for a while, and even Saint Pope Paul VI, during his pontificate, had been making moves towards the Eastern Orthodox faith as well. So he was making the point that they couldn't even decide on a common day for Easter because, as we know, the Christians celebrate Easter Sunday on a certain day and the Orthodox faith has a different Easter. And St. Pope Paul VI had suggested that perhaps it was a good idea to pick a single day in April that would work for everyone, and they couldn't even agree on that. So he, I think half-jokingly said, let's not wait for the theologians to build these bridges. We need to forge ahead.
Joe, this week, Pope Francis joined other global faith leaders in taking a very strong stand on human trafficking around the world. You wrote about this for Religion News Service. Would you please summarize this initiative for us?
Well, it's a very historic initiative by Pope Francis. He brought together at the Vatican Hindu leaders, Buddhist leaders, Jewish leaders, Muslim leaders, and even the Grand Ayatollah, one of the Grand Ayatollahs. So it was an amazing initiative to fight slavery, to wipe out slavery around the world in all its forms, whether it's human trafficking, organ trafficking, prostitution, child trafficking, by 2020. And these leaders signed a joint declaration committing themselves to this initiative. And that's a very powerful initiative across so many different faiths. And to see all these leaders at the Vatican at the same time was really quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm. You reported that the joint declaration was organized by the Global Freedom Network. Is that a religious or a secular group?
That is a multi-faith initiative that was set up earlier this year, and that also involves Jewish, Muslim, and Catholic leaders. And it was essentially driven by an Australian billionaire called Andrew Forrest, who has really been pushing this initiative to bring all these people together. And it was officially launched at the Vatican in March this year. So this is the next stage. Where do they go from next? Well, it's a tall order, isn't it? How do you wipe out human trafficking? How do you wipe out slavery? They want to try and get political leaders and religious leaders to really start by saying it's not all right, it's not okay, we have to fight this, and also go to businesses who might be sourcing materials or products in countries where people are being used as slaves to produce these products, to go to the source, go through companies and organisations and say, if you are using these practices, it's time to get rid of them and wipe them out.
Mm. Joe, how do you see the level of interreligious engagement from Pope Francis in comparison with his predecessors' efforts to involve themselves in interreligious relations?
Well, I think Pope Francis has made it very clear from the moment of his election that he's committed to this. And we've seen so much evidence of that already. He invited the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew to his initial ceremony at the Vatican when he was made a pope officially. And even from then, he's been building relationships with Muslims and Jews in particular, and reaching out to other faiths. This week during the anti-slavery initiative at the Vatican, we saw the Anglican Archbishop, the head of the Anglican Church, Reverend Justin Welby here from the UK, and he's also had continual dialogue with the Pope. So we're seeing it across many different religions, and it seems that the Pope is very committed to this and he's building on what he established as an archbishop in Buenos Aires.
Joe, as closely as you follow this Pope and his way of doing things, I'm curious, do you think most people get him? In other words, when you see mainstream news coverage of his words and his actions, does it usually reflect what you experience in your day-to-day work covering the Vatican? Do they get it?
Well, I think Pope Francis is a remarkable leader. I think we're still in a honeymoon phase, if you like, where many people see the positives. I think it's important to remember he's a shrewd leader. He's very intelligent. He's strong-willed about what he believes in. And yet we have this wonderful spontaneity about him where he might embrace a disabled person in the crowd. He telephones people who've suffered some sort of trauma or who've written to him to tell them about a personal problem. These spontaneous gestures are really quite remarkable, and his whole approach to living in a very humble way without the trappings of office, even seeing him at the anti-slavery initiative this week, sitting surrounded in the midst of the other religious leaders. He wasn't sitting above them. He was really sitting in the middle of them and speaking to the group in a very, very informal way. And I think people really respond to those gestures.
Josephine McKenna is a veteran journalist who has more than 30 years of experience in diverse media. Based in Rome, Joe covers all things Vatican for Religion News Service. You can read her work at religionnews.com, as well as in leading publications nationwide. Joe, it's been an honor for me to get to talk with you, and you are so helpful with your insights, very illuminating with your comments. I thank you for taking the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much, Welton. Have a great day, and it's been great to be part of the show.
One of the reasons we're not hearing nearly as much about Ebola these days is there are currently no known cases in the United States. We're blessed with the kind of medical care that led to remarkable survival rates for the few patients that were identified. But we're also blessed by the kind of water and sanitation that make any outbreak far more unlikely than in other parts of the world. Working to solve the water problems that plague an unconscionable proportion of humanity is the Millennium Water Challenge and Living Water International, approaching the issue from both a practical and moral perspective. And I'm very pleased to be joined by a man who has devoted many years to leadership positions in both organizations, Malcolm Morris. Mr. Morris, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Reverend Danny.
Access to safe water is such a pervasive problem in parts of the global South. So would you start with some of the raw numbers of people affected by lack of access?
My goodness. Well, and just to give a perspective, I think for those in America, our population is just over 300 million people in all of America. And yet that same number of people just on the African continent alone lack access to safe water and sanitation. So if you can imagine, think of this, every man, woman, and child in America with no access to safe water, literally having to drink out of pools of water in a gutter, out of an open lake or open stream, and think that all of your animals and everything else are similarly standing in and doing their business in that same stream of water. You can imagine what that would be like. We certainly wouldn't have any elected officials here running without a focus on water, would we?
Isn't that the truth? What regions are most impacted by this situation?
Just on a per capita basis, I think the biggest problem that we have is in Africa, although Asia, of course, has got massive numbers as well. So it's a global problem, and anywhere you have rural areas where you don't have a safe government-provided water supply, sanitation facilities, et cetera, you have problems.
Malcolm, how direct is the link between the spread of a disease like Ebola and the lack of sanitation and clean water?
I have a global business involved with actually land titling, Stewart Title. And we had an experience that affected our own company on this continent. So let me just share that with
Good.
You. If you remember the SARS outbreak years ago,
yes,
and that originated because of a chicken processing plant in rural China where they had enough water for the workers to drink, but they didn't provide the water and soap for appropriate sanitation and hygiene purposes. That's where the SARS outbreak, they traced it to. Where did it start? That's where it came out of, in China, in a rural area of China. And Stewart's offices in Toronto, Canada, were shut down for 2 weeks.
Good grief.
We're dealing with a global, you know, we all live on one planet. And people today travel by plane, they travel by boat, but plane mostly, and those planes literally fly around the world. You cannot assume that by trying to contain an outbreak like this in one part of the world that it's not going to come to America, even as we saw with the cases on the
coast. Right. Isn't that something? Against that backdrop, talk about the Water for the World Act, its genesis, and where it stands right now.
Well, very critical. We wrote the Water for Poor Act, began working with Majority Leader Bill Frist and with Earl Blumenauer, headed that up in the House of Representatives. And that, gosh, that's been, what, 2005, I guess we finally got that passed. It originated because when George Bush 43 came to office, we had the opportunity or an invitation to come up and see what USAID was doing about water. And George Bush, as governor, had supported one of the supporters of Living Water International. We had founded in 1990. So we came up and got to meet with the administrator, and he called his people in, and brand new in the job, and said, let's see what all the USAID is doing on water. And so they checked all their computers and everything else, and lo and behold, they couldn't even find water.
Goodness.
At all. And so that's what really began working. I said, oh, my goodness, you know, how can... We know they'd worked in water in the past. I said, how could we let this totally slip off our index of what we are doing? So we worked on that bill. President Bush signed that in 2005. And we have made great progress. And under the Water for the World Act, what we're trying to do is really stabilize the advances that we have made. There are reports now coming to the Congress to review, and Congress, of course, is especially interested in this. Ebola hearings going on now, et cetera. And they are currently trying to, if I would call, fix in place what we have gotten, as well as making permanent the positions that have been established now at the State Department, as well as USAID, where there is a water expert, a person in charge, who then brings that report to Congress and brings accountability to the Congress, so that the Congress that's been very interested in water will have that ear and make sure that the expenditures are being handled properly. Mm-hmm. So we are excited about it. The House passed a measure before Thanksgiving, and we are hoping that this Congress, before it retires at the end of this year, will actually vote on the new Water for the World Act in both the House and the Senate, where they are working on identical bills. All of the it's bipartisan, as everything that I've worked on in the U.S. Congress has been bipartisan basis, things that we all know that we can agree on must happen. So.
You have been personally incredibly involved in this issue, and I can't help but ask you, what made you think of water? What made you start looking at the dire situation related to water that so many people are experiencing?
Mm-hmm. Reverend Gaddy, we had my wife and I were in a couples Bible study as newlyweds.
Mm-hmm.
We formed a relationship actually with two NASA space scientists, if you will, and they were not able to have more children in their 50s. They had a miracle child. His name was Cade. And at 18 months, Cade drowned. And they had become our dearest and closest friends. And they struggled with this together and said, you know, we've got to do something for somebody else and just quit focusing on us. And their trip coming up to Africa. So that I was just taking over our global operations of Stewart at the time. And I was telling him how I certainly didn't have time to go to Africa. But we went with them. My wife had always wanted to go. And so she prayed about going, and we went, took our boys. And on that trip, the Lord had really sent a man, given him a vision on how to build a small rig that could be taken in places where big rigs couldn't go. So he was on that trip. I was the former legislative aide to Charlie Wilson, and the government of Kenya. We were working in Mombasa. Government of Kenya had locked up all of our equipment that this gentleman had prepared. And so the missionary said, is there anybody here who knows how to deal with government? So he and I were thrown together in 1990. We formed Living Water International to address the water crisis. What we saw as the excitement of the community, when you came in to drill water for the community, it was dancing, hugging, and so forth. And you just saw the joy that water brings. And, and it was, we came back and from that trip, formed Living Water International. And the kind of the rest is history today, Living Water International, serving over 16 million people worldwide.
Mr. Morris, if we have listeners who weren't aware of these organizations and this effort, how can they learn more about the Millennium Water Alliance and Living Water International?
Well, what, Living Water International is real simple. It's on the web at water.cc. It's, that stands for Charitable Corporation. The Millennium Water Alliance now is like 16 organizations. All of them have been personally vetted. One thing that I learned in working around the world is the importance of putting the people that you are working with and for. And I don't, and I'm saying that very carefully.
Sure.
That you put them first.
Yeah.
This is not about us, and it's not about our solutions. It's about meeting with the bottom billion people in the world and advising them and seeing what their circumstances are and what they can understand and can maintain, and then helping to educate them and helping them be a part of establishing that water need. So if anything, it's a principle that Christ taught, you know, think about the others. Don't go in and do things to people, and don't go in and do voodoo and provide them something and leave. They must be a very much a part of what you're doing.
What is one thing that our listeners could do that you would like for them to do to express support for this effort?
Each state has two senators, and if you would address your senators to Senate Bill 2986, that is the Water for the World Act, And if you would just call their offices today, writing a letter, it doesn't do much good because they're scanned and takes a long time to get there. But if you call their offices today and just express support for Senate Bill 2986, that would be absolutely terrific. And, you know, I just noticed there's a guy named Matthew Paris, and he's a journalist for the London Times, a former member of parliament, grew up in Malawi. And I think he went back 45 years later, and he stated this, and I'm just going to read his quote, that as a confirmed atheist, I have become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christians make in Africa. And he said the work of secular NGOs, government projects, so forth, international aid efforts, those are appreciated, but these alone will not do. Education and strong help like this just don't do it. In Africa, Christianity, said, what I saw, Christianity changes people's hearts and brings a spiritual transformation, and the rebirth is real. He said, I see it in the eyes of the community as I walk there. And that's from a man who says, I'm an atheist, but I see a difference. The Millennium Water Alliance, MWAwater.org, it's both faith-based and humanitarian organizations, but we can work together on principles that respect the local person and at the same time provide the life-saving, safe water, sanitation, and health and hygiene that they need. And, hey, it affects us, too. There's a reason for each of us to be involved, and the Millennium Water Alliance members together globally are serving over 100 million people a day. So it's a blessing to me. I can tell you, it is an absolute blessing.
Malcolm Morris is the Executive Vice President of Living Water International and the founder and chairman of the Millennium Water Alliance. Mr. Morris, it's the kind of structural solutions that you're engaged in pursuing that are the only hope for breaking the cycle of crises that so often seem to define our age. It's critically important work. I want to thank you for people who aren't ever going to get a chance to sit down and talk with you but want to express gratitude. And I really thank you for being with us today to talk about all of this on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Weldon, and on behalf of all the people that are being served, let me provide a thank you to all of your listeners.
Now, before we go, I've simply got to talk with you about something that is troubling me greatly, something that's going on in our nation. So much of what I've witnessed in recent days related to police actions and to decisions of grand juries in Ferguson, Missouri, and in New York City evoke flashbacks to experiences of racial injustice that I lived through in the late 1950s and throughout the 1960s, and finally thought I never would have to live through again. I'm not a lawyer, but I respect lawyers. The same can be said of my views on law enforcement officers. I have no interest in debunking or weakening in any way the processes of justice in our land. But, friends, I simply have to tell you, I think something is wrong. Something is bad wrong right now. As is always the case, there are sick, immoral people among us who want to use difficult situations in communities as opportunities to divide those communities and advance their own agendas that have nothing to do with justice. I despise that reality, though I have to acknowledge it. But we cannot allow the actions of a few unconscionable people to divert our attention from deadly wrongs that patriotic and morally conscientious people consider threats to the vitality of justice in our democracy and the validity of the view that all people are individuals of dignity and worth and merit equality. State of Belief is a radio program devoted to civility, the highest values in our democracy, and reconciliation where there is division. Yes, we have a religious perspective. I claim no competence in knowing how to turn around a situation that's growing more frightening and disturbing every day. But I want to highlight and bring to our microphones people who have such knowledge. On next week's State of Belief, I will bring together people of conscience, conviction, wisdom, and vision. I'll ask them for help. Is my dis-ease wrong? I will ask them, and I want them to tell me so if I'm wrong. I'll seek their counsel as to the best next steps for a nation that, after all of these years, is still trying to deal with race. Now, not only do I hope you will listen to that show, I want you to be a part of it. I am inviting you to contribute to that show. Please share with us feelings you have experienced, questions that you won't ask, and issues on which you would appreciate good counsel. Look, I know it's a holiday season. As a minister, I will conduct rituals of celebration. But the values of our religious traditions that we celebrate at this time of the year ultimately will be strengthened not by our songs and parties, but by our pragmatic actions that assure the values in our democracy, the values in our religions that are for the good of all people, find expression in courthouses and on the streets of our hurting nation. You can call our listener line 202-681-4246. Leave your message so we can hear it. Or you can also weigh in using social media. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. The same goes for Twitter. We're at twitter.com/stateofbelief. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Encouraging in many ways was today's show. Challenging will be next week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential in keeping this show on the air. A big thank you to listeners who've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. We need you in this community. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. A very special show it will be. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what?